Welcome to New World Notes, hosted by Kenneth Doust. This week, we say goodbye to the incumbent president, and economist Richard D. Wolff says goodbye to capitalism. I hope you'll stay tuned. Today, we feature much of an excellent interview with progressive economist Richard D. Wolff. The talk is titled, COVID-19 and the End of Capitalism. But before we go there, I must mention a few current events here in the late fall of 2020. First, two deaths. S. Michael DeRosa. Mike DeRosa died on October 16. Mike was longtime public affairs director of my home station, WWUH-FM, in Connecticut. For about the past three decades, Mike produced the progressive-oriented radio interview program, New Focus. He was also co-chair of the Green Party of Connecticut and sometimes candidate for statewide office. 13 years ago, Mike recruited me to do a weekly radio show for WWUH, and what I came up with was New World Notes. Mike is much missed throughout Connecticut, including by yours truly. Then, the distinguished British foreign correspondent Robert Fisk died on October 30th. From 1976 onwards, his beat was the Middle East. He well earned his reputation as a Middle East expert, and as a reporter of great integrity, honesty, and courage. Like many Americans, I discovered Fisk around the turn of the century, when the United States chose to go to war against large parts of the Middle East. Robert Fisk appeared a few times on New World Notes. The most recent was in February 2019, in an installment titled simply, Robert Fisk and Chris Hedges. You'll find a copy of that show on our website, if you'd care to check it out. A third current event was a happier one to many of our listeners. It now seems probable that the man who labored long and hard to make America number one in coronavirus deaths and number one in coronavirus death rate, the man who dedicated his presidency to increasing global warming, abrogating peace treaties, and ridding America of unsightly face masks, the man who is starting to give the narcissistic personality disorder community a bad name, yes, fearless leader appears to have lost the November 3rd election, though as I speak, he has not conceded defeat. New World Notes does not take sides in political contests, but now that the election is over, I hope and pray that it is over. Now, I think we could note that some very clever people were hoping for a little regime change here at home. Among these clever people is musician and satirist Roy Zimmerman. Before the election, he arranged a large remote musical collaboration. It resulted in a pre-election anti-Trump music video. The song was a travesty of the 1961 pop hit Wim Mouet, or The Lion Sleeps Tonight, by The Tokens. Remember that one? In fact, one of Zimmerman's collaborators was The Tokens' lead singer, Jay Siegel. Others included Phil Proctor of the Firesign Theater, Lacey J. Dalton, Tom Hartman, and a bunch of folks I didn't recognize. The Lion Sleeps Tonight had South African roots, including a musical ground that went wim mwe, a wim mwe, a wim mwe, over and over. The 2020 version changes a wim mwe to vote him away, vote him away, vote him away. And it redoes all the other lyrics in the spirit of Mad Magazine. It even throws in a few bars of Walk Like an Egyptian and, I think, at the very end, See You in September. There appear to be 4 versions of this music video on YouTube. They're all similar, but I like number 4 the best. Without further ado, here are Roy Zimmerman and unindicted co-conspirators singing Vote Him Away, or The Liar Tweets Tonight.
White House, the liar tweets tonight. Big blue wave gonna drown him out as he meets defeat tonight. They shrugged and closed their eyes. They propped him up and they fell in line and repeated all his lies.
Put them away, 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 put them away.
Vote like American.
Vote them away,
oh, way,
away,
oh,
way, oh, way, oh, way, oh, way, oh,
oh, way, 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 oh, way,
so much for late-breaking current events. Now on to business, so to speak, and the business of America is business. Distinguished economist Richard D. Wolff is one of the most articulate critics of the system we call capitalism. He is very ably interviewed by a very sharp and decidedly leftist young video blogger from Toronto. She is known to the world as Mexi, M-E-X-I-E. The odd thing about Mexi is that she is well-dressed, well-groomed, and beautiful by conventional standards. Turn off the sound of her video, and you'd half expect her to be plugging some all-natural herbal skincare product. Turn on the sound, and she's asking sharp questions about capitalist ideology, the bourgeoisie, and Marx's theory of surplus value. I love the cognitive dissonance here. Here are selections from the interview of September 15, 2020. It is titled COVID-19 and the End of Capitalism with Professor Emeritus Richard D. Wolff.
Where do you think we are right now? How does our current moment compare to the Great Depression in terms of employment, housing, and food security? And where do you see things heading in the next 5 to 10 years?
This is the worst crash of American capitalism since the Great Depression. So that means everybody watching, listening to this program, this is the worst economic crash in our lifetimes, all of us. It is a profound testimony to the fundamental instability of the capitalist system. If you look at the history of capitalism, both in the United States and anywhere else in the world where it has settled, it has an economic downturn. And by the way, many words for it: recession, depression, bust, crash. I mean, the language is full of it. Why? Because it happens on average every 4 to 7 years. That is for centuries. everything has been tried in capitalism to get rid of this instability, because the capitalists, the people who like capitalism, always understood correctly that a system that crashes like this every 4 to 7 years, throwing millions of people out of work, destroying businesses, interrupting or destroying educations, breaking up families, this disaster happening every 4 to 7 years is hardly a recommendation for the system. And so they tried, they really did try, using their best minds to figure out a way to stop it from happening. Give you an example. The Great Depression of the 1930s, the president then, Franklin Roosevelt, went on the radio and gave a famous speech. And in the speech, he said, I have some plans for how to get us out of this depression. And I want you to support me. And I promise you in exchange that these measures that I'm proposing will not only get us out of this depression, but will prevent us from having more depressions so that our children will not suffer this kind of collapse of the economy the way we are. Roosevelt promised it, and every president since has promised it. Hmm. But no president has ever been able to deliver on the promise. The promise has been betrayed, and we are now in the biggest betrayal since the Great Depression. The unemployment rates we have now are Depression-era unemployment rates. The collapse of production, likewise. But let me review the three that we've had in our new century, because in a way they illustrate the point. Early in the spring of 2000, we had a crash of our economy. We called it the dot-com crash. Why? Because the prices of shares of dot-com companies had gone through the roof in the stock market. Now, you didn't have to be a genius to understand that prices of shares go through the roof from time to time without causing a crash. So blaming it on the prices didn't make too much sense, but it was very helpful to distract people from asking the obvious question, why is this system crashing again, having been told that we had learned from the earlier crashes how to avoid it? Didn't work. We had a crash. 7 years later, in 2008, we had another crash. The only difference was it had a different name. It was called the subprime mortgage crash. Again, blaming the trigger rather than the system that's unstable. It was worse than the one in 2000. And here we are in the year 2020. Boom. We got the third one of this century, and this one we're going to be calling the COVID-19 crash or something like that. Once again, blaming the trigger that happens just at the same time rather than the system. 20 years of a new century, three crashes, works out to a little under 7 years. Bingo, just what we would expect. And most people knew that this crash was coming and predicted it long before we knew anything about the virus and what it would do. So for me, I see this as the worst crash of the three. That's not a good sign. Mm-hmm. It shows us that the measures taken after 2000 didn't prevent or reduce the awfulness of the one in 2008. And now again, only more so since 2008 to this one. We have the pandemic, which no doubt makes it much worse. This is a system that seems to me to, and let me stop with that, to have failed. I mean, there's no nice way to say this. You know, viruses have been with us from day one. It's part of nature. Viruses are things in nature that can be very toxic to plants, to animals, to people. We had a terrible one 100 years ago in 1918, very famous. Mm-hmm. People know about it. We've had more recent ones, MERS, SARS, Ebola. I mean, we know, and we should have been prepared. What in the world is wrong with a system that didn't prepare mm-hmm. for what we knew was coming? Sort mm-hmm. of the same question that the fires in the West Coast are making us at. We knew what was mm-hmm. coming, and oh, here we are with mm-hmm. more of our fingers in our noses because we haven't gotten ready, and now we're not containing it. Mm-hmm. The United States is a rich capitalist country. We have 4.5% of the population of the world and over 20% of the COVID cases and the COVID deaths. Mm-hmm. That failure of a system. Last point, you know, why do I keep saying it's a failure of this system? Here's the way to make it really clear. I understand that no capitalist company of the kind that might produce tests or masks or ventilators or hospital beds, they're not going to produce those beds, store them in a warehouse somewhere, make sure they stay, you know, in good shape for an indefinite amount of time before they can sell it. They're not going to do that because it isn't profitable. And capitalism says to the company, you do what's profitable and you avoid what isn't. So they don't produce those things. Okay, we all understand that. The government then can compensate for the failure of private capitalism to manage this situation. By the way, this situation is called public health and is a fundamental need of human beings. So private capitalism stinks at taking care of public health for the reasons we all understand. Well, the government could come in, and you know, the government could buy up tests, masks, ventilators, ICU units, all the rest of it, and store them around the country and make sure they stay in good shape, replace them if they wear out, blah, 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 blah. We know the government can do it because that's what it does with military equipment. It doesn't pay a company to produce a tank or a machine gun or an airplane. So the government comes in, buys all that stuff, making a nice profit for the companies that produce them. And then the government, at its own expense, that is you and me, pay for storing it and locating it around the country for a military emergency. But our government didn't do that for a medical emergency. Mm-hmm. So we were unprepared, and we are now paying the price, 200,000 nearly dead. I mean, it's unspeakable what's going on. The failure is catastrophic. I don't think I have to explain to people that we can do better than capitalism. We're living through the proof of it.
Yes, absolutely. That was incredibly well said. So you mentioned, you know, what the government could have done that they're not doing. At the beginning of this crisis, I actually thought that this could really, really shake up. This could be the end of capitalism as we know it, because I wrongfully assumed that the ruling class, the politicians, you know, they would be forced to make some concessions. They would be forced to provide debt relief, rent relief, maybe even basic income, if only to avoid the inevitable unrest and the, you know, possible radicalization of the masses. However, they've only provided $1,200 so far, and now millions of Americans stand to become homeless on January 1st. Why do you think the bourgeoisie is taking such an incredible risk? And do you really think they're going to just let this happen?
You know, that's a wonderful question. And, you know, I put it almost this way. In the history of the collapse of empires, the Greek Empire, the Roman Empire, the British Empire, when the historians go back, they look at the years, and sometimes we're talking decades, before the thing collapses, and they say to themselves as they look at the history, how could these people not have seen what was coming down the pike at them? Why in the world didn't they do this or that, which seems, with our 2020 hindsight, to be the obvious thing you should have done. We have it even worse now, because what the United States did is much worse in terms of the risk the bourgeoisie is taking than they did in Germany. I mean, or Europe. Let me give you an example. Before the pandemic hits Germany, unemployment was 5%. Over the summer, unemployment in Germany rose to 6%. In other words, very little. We went from 4.5% to 20%. I mean, it's a spectacular difference. Why? Because in Germany, it was understood that had the government thrown millions of people out of work, allowed that to happen, those millions of people would have left their job and gone right into the street, and Germany would have come to a halt. They know that. And it's true in France and Italy, and you fill in the blank. Right? They couldn't. Here in the United States, it's a different situation. They can, and they think they can go quite a bit further. And they think that because for the last 25 years, they've been going further, bit by bit, leading people like you and me to ask exactly your question. How in the world do they dare do that? And the answer is they were worried, but they saw there was no apparent cost. Now, it's still a risk. You're still right to wonder because, yeah, nothing may be happening, but under the surface, who knows? Let me be very concrete. We have a labor movement, the AFL-CIO, right? It is the dominating labor movement of this country. We have the worst unemployment since the Great Depression. Has the labor movement called for a demonstration? No. Has it brought people into the streets? No. Has it raised hell in 27 different ways? No. So the people who say, "What we gave the unemployed an extra $600, the Republicans are now proposing to reduce it to $300. Why should they give $600? Mm-hmm. Make the mass of people desperate. It mm-hmm. seems that you can kick them and they don't kick back. Mm-hmm. And therefore, and they're scared, by the way. Let me, I don't want to leave the wrong impression. The people running this society know how bad it is, mm-hmm. and they're very worried. They're borrowing money. We have a $3 trillion debt this year in the budget. We never had that before, except in World War II, and even then, not this big. They're very worried that mm-hmm. as these debts accumulate, the American people are going to have political leaders who are going to say, gee, if the debt is so high and that's costing us so much, let's reduce the debt. And here's a way to do it. We can tax corporations and the rich, pay back the people with the government borrowed from, and then we'll all be better off and the rich will still be rich. They just won't be obscenely rich. The obscenely rich understand this very well. They want to keep this from getting to that point. So mm-hmm. it's interesting for them to reduce what we give to unemployed people from 600 to 300. That way they slow and postpone the day when all of this comes due. So mm-hmm. that's why they do it, and they think they can get away with it. Mm-hmm. By the way, all those empires fell because they kept doing it. And then they did it the last time when it turns out you couldn't get away with it. My suspicion is we may be very well down that path. Yes, the United States doesn't push back. The Americans don't. But mm-hmm. when they finally do, watch out.
Right. Yeah, I feel like they're just counting on our ignorance of the situation, basically, and our ignorance of political economy in general, and just seeing how far they can go, because they can't, if they did those things, if they did give debt relief and all of those things, it would be kind of admitting that the whole ethos of American and Americana is wrong, right?
Absolutely. Here's a wonderful way to capture that. Mm-hmm. If you look around, you will notice that in recent months, conservative people, right-wing people, the people who used to attack welfare moms, you know, single mothers with children who had to take care of the kids and couldn't go to work and therefore went on the dole or went on welfare and got welfare payments, were being attacked as lazy or criminal or all the rest of it. You don't hear that. You don't hear it. And the reason you don't hear it, I'm convinced, is because welfare is how everybody now lives. Mm-hmm. Let me give you just two examples. One third of all mortgages in the United States are now owned by the Federal Reserve System of this country. In other words, here's how it works. Mr. and Mrs. Smith go to the bank to borrow money to buy a house. Mr. and Mrs. Smith borrow the money and they write an IOU. It's called a mortgage. They owe the bank X dollars and they pay it off so much every month. Here's what happens. The bank immediately, I mean within minutes of the papers being signed, the local bank sells that mortgage to the Federal Reserve, which gives them cash so they can do it all again with Browns and Greens and everybody else in the community. Mm-hmm. Well, the ultimate creditor, the one who provides the money to keep the housing market going, is the government. Mm-hmm. The housing market is on welfare. Mm-hmm. The Federal Reserve simply prints the money and hands it out to the banks, currently at almost no interest rate. So the bank is happy, gets this cheap money, turns around and lends it to people who want to buy a house at 3, 4, 5%. They've borrowed it at half of 1%. Mm-hmm. Money for the bank, lots of houses can be financed, but they're all on welfare. It's government money makes it possible. Here's just an example. The Federal Reserve is now buying what are called corporate bonds. Here's how that works. A company has a problem. It can't pay its workers. It can't sell its output. It has an outmoded technology. Whatever the problem is, here's now the easiest way to solve it. You go to the Federal Reserve. You write out a bond. I want to borrow money at an interest rate of half of 1%. That's the easiest, cheapest way to solve whatever problem your company has, which is why American corporations today are deeper in debt than they have ever been in the history of the country. Who's holding that debt? Who's the creditor? The Federal Reserve. Mm-hmm. In other words, corporations are all on welfare. They're getting a cheap, just like if you're on Section 8 in this country and you get help with your rent, you're a family in difficulty, you get help. You're a corporation in difficulty, you get help from the Federal Reserve. You can't make fun of the welfare mom anymore because she's the least of the recipients of welfare. It's all the rich corporations and so forth who are living off of the government. It's the failure of private capitalism, you bet. Colossal. But the conservatives will continue to celebrate the private enterprise that isn't there anymore. Because they're holding, but that's the sign of a collapsing empire. Mm-hmm. And it has to make things up that are so completely disconnected from the real world that it really is becoming a matter of time until that disconnect catches up with them.
Here we must end Richard Wolff on why capitalism simply cannot be made to work, except for the plutocracy, for whom it works just fine. For the 99.9%, not so well. There are some more good insights by Wolff that we didn't have time for today. We'll hear them on another day. The interviewer was Mexi. You can find Mexi's videos on YouTube, and you can find New World Notes at our website, which is newworldnotes.blogspot.com. From Darkest Connecticut, this is Kenneth Doust, thanking you for listening, reminding you that in solidarity there is strength, and hoping you'll tune in again next week. And as we began with a song about our 45th president, let us end with one about him as well. Peace.